Under the circumstances, the Tibetan robbers did not confiscate all my food, but only a portion of it, leaving me a little so that I should not starve on the way. Finally, the egotism of the Tibetan robbers does not seem to be of the boundless variety. It is crude, but it is not boundless. Chapter 4. Tibetan Civilization. I often happened to overhear talks, sometimes even confidential talks, of lamas and ordinary Tibetans, but soon after reaching the inhabited area I had the rare pleasure of overhearing a long conversation between three wealthy Tibetans wearing expensive turquoise earrings and accompanied by a large number of servants armed with sticks. It is not pleasant for a poorly clad Tibetan to meet such wealthy people accompanied by their servants, as he may not step aside quickly enough, or forget to thrust out his tongue, which is considered a mark of respect in Tibet, or he may fail to stand up when important people wearing expensive earrings are passing, thus giving the servants a chance to ingratiate themselves with their masters by giving him a good licking. I did not move out of the way when they approached, but when the servants learned from a few educated Tibetans who had just tried to talk to me that I was a deaf and dumb traveler, I was not molested by them, and the three Tibetan notabilities happened to stop and to talk within hearing distance of me. With a majestic gesture, the servants were sent away to buy food. Rich Tibetans shout instead of talking, and they fairly roar instead of laughing. The greater the volume of a man's voice, the richer and the more powerful he is supposed to be in Tibet. The wealthy Tibetans thought that they were quite alone, the deaf and dumb traveler being the only person within hearing distance. They lowered their voices and began to make jokes about the lamas while they cast suspicious glances in all directions, since the priests in Tibet are a very powerful body, a fact which even rich Tibetans are very wise to bear in mind. "Yes," said one of them, "and this thing happened at X." He mentioned a place in northeastern Tibet where the brigands, quite unlike the nice robbers in western Tibet, are notorious for their cruelty. A few months ago the brigands did not hesitate to attack a lama. "A lama!" exclaimed the other. "How extraordinary that they should not show a little more respect for their competitors." When the robbers approached threateningly, continued the other, they noticed that the lama was trembling with fear. Then one of the robbers said to him, "What, holy man, you tremble? If someone kills me, I go straight to hell, but you go straight to paradise. If I kill you, why do you tremble then?" "It's true, I should go to paradise," answered the trembling lama, "but life is so nice after all." The three Tibetans laughed heartily, and their false silver teeth were clearly visible. When distinguished Tibetans open their mouths, one can see pointed silver capsules covering their teeth. These silver capsules are the Tibetan equivalent of our gold crowns. Only rich Tibetans can afford artificial teeth. "And what happened to the lama?" asked the other one. "He had made the robbers laugh so much," came the answer, "that they did not hurt him at all." At that moment the servants returned and the three Tibetan notabilities instantly stopped their jokes about the lamas. They probably did not care a straw for lamas, religion, or paradise, but thought it best to keep their opinion of the priesthood to themselves, it being much better for them if others believed in lamas and religion. Now that they felt that their conversation was overheard, they became conventional and their talk was soon quite meaningless. It would be a great mistake to suppose that in the wide open spaces of Tibet, with their scarce population, all ceremonies, all make-believe, and all prejudices are non-existent. On the contrary, the Tibetans seem to be very punctilious on questions of etiquette. The few hundred wise men of Tibet seem to be the only Tibetans who do not care for any kind of make-believe. Hospitable Tibetans of the wealthier class offer food to their guests again and again as soon as their bowl is empty, but woe to the man who takes this kind offer at face value if the invitation to help himself is extended a third time. No matter how great the appearance of sincerity, a third offer is intended to be a purely theatrical affair, and the guest filling up his bowl for a third time would be put down as an uneducated person. Tibetan nomads and other very simple folk have no time for such things, however, and with them such ceremonies and pretense are unnecessary. Only young Tibetans occasionally revolt against insincerity and this playing of theater in their daily lives, but in most cases they are soon forced into submission to the rules. The education of the younger generation in Tibet is mostly catered for in the monasteries, although there are a few schools outside them. There the young Tibetans have to listen to many meaningless speeches and gradually the thing so boastingly called education distorts their boyish common sense, cripples their enthusiasm, and turns them into selfish little imitative machines that do everything precisely in the same way as it is done by everybody. Young people, especially boys, in Tibet always instinctively desired my company. I am reasonably certain that no Tibetan youngster would have denounced me to the lamas had he found out that I was a white intruder. Older Tibetans might have done it. It is very difficult and painful to the young to be gradually forced into the grooves of Tibetan civilization with its many insufficiencies, traditions, and inner contradictions. The sheepish attitude of the Tibetan masses is illustrated by the fact that the Tibetans never wash from birth to death. Although there are many lakes in Tibet, the population has washed with butter and mustard for centuries past. Everybody is doing what everybody else is doing, and once a thing has become traditional, people cease to think whether a well-established habit is foolish or not. The ways of the Tibetans are frightfully filthy. They often drink water flowing out from dunghills. It may happen that liquids from dead bodies come into direct contact with food. On one occasion I was very kindly offered food prepared with knives which had been used a few hours before for cutting up a dead body. I refused to take it. The people present were greatly astonished that I was not hungry and none of them seemed to guess the reason why I had refused. Often dung is picked up with the hands for use as fuel, and then the hands are not cleaned and food is put into the mouth with fingers sticky with dung. In some of the villages refuse is simply thrown out into the streets until it reaches up to the level of the roofs, thus literally burying the inhabitants in their own dirt. Tibet thus ranks amongst the filthiest countries in the world, but the white traveler would do wrong to hold contempt for the Tibetans on account of their filthy habits and to feel superior to them on that account. It is true that the Tibetans are rather filthy outwardly, but they are probably cleaner where white people are often not clean at all, viz. In their hearts, white people are often scrupulously clean outwardly, but they may inwardly entertain many evil thoughts. I am sometimes able to feel people's thoughts to a small degree. That is why I did not suffer very much from the physical uncleanliness of Tibet. I do not mean to claim that the Tibetans are faultless. Far from it. But they are much more careful than white people not to harm themselves and their surroundings by evil thoughts. The spiritual aspect of things is much more seriously taken into account in Tibet than their material side. Thoughts and feelings are considered as realities, just as real as visible things and human actions. Such a conception does not usually occur to white people. Even if they were given education in a Western sense on Western lines, I doubt whether the Tibetans would ever equal the white man intellectually. But they probably have finer intuition than most white people. Married people in Tibet, I imagine, have very little difficulty in finding out about how their husbands or wives are disposed to them. It is difficult for a white person to penetrate into the marital secrets of the Tibetans. Viewing these matters superficially, I must say that I never saw a single instance of jealousy or a single matrimonial scene throughout my travel in Tibet, not even where several husbands were married to one wife, which is a fairly widely spread practice with Tibetan farmers, although uncommon amongst nomads. In most parts of Tibet I ingratiated myself with young ladies by asking them in Tibetan, "Kailatugataka Pasentando?" That is, how many children have you got? This is a question you may put to any young lady in Tibet with perfect safety. It is difficult to judge by outward signs the degree of affection people hold for the other members of their family. In one case, where someone had just died, the attitude of the nearest relatives seemed to me to be a little callous, judging by Western standards, but perhaps the Tibetans make an effort to hide their feelings in such circumstances. I saw tears of joy and emotion in Tibet, but hardly ever tears of sorrow. Attending a Tibetan funeral is a terrible experience. I once had to do so, The Tibetan had been dead for several days. I learned that the family were satisfied that his soul would rest in peace because he had had the good luck to die in the presence of a Lama who had been called in time. The Lama had sung certain queer songs which nobody could understand, and then he had touched several times the crown of the dying man's head. When a person is dying, the Lamas touch the crown of his head. It is a general belief in Tibet that this facilitates the escape of the soul from the body, the soul rising out of the body through the crown of the head. Ever since the Tibetan had died, the Lama had remained seated near the dead body. Food was brought for both, that is to say for the dead man as well as for the Lama. The latter ate really and the former symbolically. Funeral preparations are elaborate in Tibet. They constitute a considerable source of income for the Tibetan priesthood, who like to complicate matters as much as possible. Finally, the hour fixed for the funeral arrived. The Lama performed elaborate rites and incantations. Then the dead body, without being put into a coffin or case, was carried out, the Lama walking immediately behind it, while a small group of relatives and close friends followed at a certain distance. We arrived at a place where many human bones were scattered in all directions. Large white or whitish stone slabs covered the ground. The dead body was put on the ground, and then two men armed with big knives began to cut up the body after stripping off the dead man's clothes and handing them respectfully to the Lama, who took them as a funeral fee or a contribution towards his funeral fee. During this ghastly scene, no one cried, and no one amongst the relatives or friends present showed any visible sign of sorrow. The pieces of flesh cut from the dead body were thrown out in a circle where a good many birds had gathered for this strange meal. Suddenly a few ravens mingled with the more respectable birds and began devouring the dead man's flesh. Since, however, ravens are disliked by the Tibetans, who do not seem to like the flesh from the bodies of their dead to go into such degraded bodies, a few of the people in the funeral party picked up stones and cast them at the ravens with great dexterity. How did such ghastly funeral rites come into existence? There is an apparent reason for them. This method of disposing of the dead necessitates less work than burial, and cremation is impossible in most parts of Tibet owing to lack of wood. They could not burn their dead on a fire made of yak dung, which commonly serves them as fuel. But there is also a deeper and much more valid reason for cutting up the Tibetan dead. Some of the wise men of Tibet gave me hints regarding the matter. If dead bodies were not cut up soon after death, the Tibetans would be afraid that evil spirits might enter into them. Only in the case of very holy lamas of high rank do the Tibetans occasionally bury the dead bodies, after soaking them in molten butter. In the case of such holy people, the evil spirits are supposed to be powerless. Moreover, such lamas are buried inside the monasteries where evil spirits are driven away again and again by an elaborate system of incantations. But in the case of ordinary Tibetans, who are not so well protected, simple burial would be too dangerous. Sometimes magicians who rule over hosts of evil spirits are credited with the power to send out an evil spirit with the mission of entering the body of a dead man. Only by radical destruction of human corpses can this purpose be foiled. This belief is not specifically Tibetan. There are other countries in the world where the relatives of persons just buried even guard the tombs of their deceased with loaded guns. In Haiti, for instance, to prevent people versed in magic from getting hold of and misusing the corpses before the latter have reached an advanced stage of putrefaction. Very often human bones are used in Tibet. Prayer mills, censers, and sometimes whole aprons are made of human bones. At times, too, magicians use sticks to which one or a whole range of human skulls are attached. Now, after reading all this, the reader should not imagine that the Tibetans think they live in an uncivilized country. Like most other people, they have a very high opinion of themselves, and their opinion about themselves seems only to be higher the less they happen to know about others. There are even Tibetans who consider Tibet the most civilized country in the world, which reminds one of the saying of the French writer who defined civilization as "ce qui est préfère de nous." Some Tibetans are even of the opinion that poor barren Tibet is the most fertile country and the garden of the world, and that is why her bad neighbors cast covetous eyes on Tibet. In the eyes of many Tibetans, Tibet is just as powerful a country as England or Russia. I was surprised to hear a Lama refer to the young Usmund expedition as the great war between Tibet and India. The broad masses of the Tibetans, however, do not seem to care much for the position of Tibet in the world. They consider all questions of power as part of the material aspect of things, and matter for them is something negligible. Hence their utter indifference to improvements of their material condition and to the very idea of progress in a Western sense. Like 2/3 of the population of India, nearly all Tibetans believe in reincarnation. They believe that in the past they lived on this earth in other bodies and that they will come back to this earth in other bodies again and again. They consider their lives to be a mere day in a much longer existence extending over millions of years, the soul, after a period of rest, passing again into the body of a newborn child. It is believed that a grown-up person spends many hundred years in paradise or hell according to the virtues amassed or sins committed in the last existence before having squared his accounts relative to the past existence by pleasure or pain. Then his soul descends into the body of a newborn child again. Children, however, on meeting an untimely death, have no accounts to settle in heaven or hell and are reborn therefore almost immediately. Such souls, according to the Tibetans, often carry the memory of the last incarnation over into the new existence, and if one believes the Tibetans, it often happens that quite a young child distinctly remembers having been a child in a neighboring village, and when it is taken to the place described as the place of his previous existence, he will recognize his father and mother, his toys, household utensils, clothes, and the like, and his former parents and relatives will confirm the veracity of his statements. Cases of this kind are far too frequent in Tibet to be accounted for by the convenient explanation of a plot preconcerted by the many people concerned in order to become the topic of gossip in the district. Book from the 60s on this, https://rune.galactic.to/spoker/20_cases_suggestive_of_reincarnation.epub. The holier a person, the Tibetans say, the more he or she is likely to remember details from his or her previous incarnations. Even if the memory of past incarnations is lost in later life, the Tibetans say that it exists to a certain degree at the age of 7 in the case of souls of a higher degree of evolution. Going by this rule and claiming that they are holy, practically all the lamas declare that they can remember their past incarnations. On the other hand, I never heard any of the wise men of Tibet, who for the most part live outside the monasteries, say anything about their past incarnations. They may remember them, but are very reluctant to talk about them. These men are holy. It is not necessary for them, therefore, to make an effort to appear holy and to emphasize their holiness by stories of past incarnations and pretended memories of past incarnations. What is the actual basis for this belief in reincarnation which is so common in the East? Is there logical justification for it? This is how one of the wise hermits of Tibet explained it to me in his clear and lucid manner. Can life spring from something that is not life? He asked. No, I replied. If the soul of man is created out of nothing, he went on, it is likely to go back into nothing. If we shall live forever in the future, observed another wise hermit, we must have lived always in the past. Reincarnation is a lofty symbol of the oneness of life. If the idea of reincarnation is approached with an open heart and mind, the illusion of separating the I from the non-I disappears. The I and the non-I are really the same thing, and it is just as foolish to treat that which is not I in a way different to the way one treats one's eye, as it would be foolish to treat one's left arm in a way different to one's right arm. But the illusion of the I consciousness is very tenacious. The I eagerly snatches anything, be it even a floating piece of straw, to nourish its self-centeredness. A bigoted conception of reincarnation tends to strengthen the false I consciousness and it subtly increases the division between the I and the non-I. When the idea of reincarnation is not approached with an open heart and mind, and when it is used to give comfort to the I by holding out a promise of its continuation after death, The division between the I and the non-I is subtly strengthened. Only when every notion of gaining or getting is discarded and reincarnation stands out as a lofty symbol and not as a safety belt for the I, can it help to break down the false egocentrical conception of life. Reincarnation should be a lofty symbol. In actual fact, in most cases it is merely used as a safety belt for the I. If an individual abstains from doing harm to others because he thinks he will get a good incarnation in future by doing so, he transplants the materialistic attitude of gaining and getting into the spiritual sphere. This is no longer spirituality but materialistic spirituality or spiritual materialism, that is the very reverse of real spirituality. A bigoted and egocentrical conception of reincarnation, by the way, is fundamentally similar to any other bigoted conception of religion. What is the difference between a person who is afraid to commit an evil action from fear of hell and a person abstaining from committing an evil action from fear of a bad reincarnation? Many people who have adopted an orthodox theosophical conception of life think they are more advanced or more religious than people having an orthodox belief in some of the dogmatic religions. But they are mistaken. They have only changed the form but not the contents. Fundamentally, they still hold the same beliefs in another form. The lofty Hindu teachings of old speak of the divine, the ever-present, immovable spirit of the universe that passes all understanding, that can only be understood as a principle of eternal oneness as opposed to the turmoil of manifestation. The spirit of these teachings has been corrupted. The idea of reincarnation expressed the oneness of life as a lofty symbol. It is accepted in a narrow-minded and bigoted spirit, and in practice the reincarnation idea is turned into a safety belt for the I. In all probability it is this bigoted conception of the idea of reincarnation which makes the population of Tibet and the non-Mohammedan section of the population of India so indolent and careless in the sphere of material activity. They have time and lots of time for everything. Things will work themselves out in the next incarnation, they say. Anyhow, all eternity is before them in which to solve their problems. In all probability that is why they do not live so much in the present. Chapter 5 The Strange Doings of the Lama's Great Caution was necessary whenever I visited a Tibetan monastery. To have been found out by the Lamas would have been a terrible experience. I do not think they would have killed me, since human life is nearly always respected in Tibet. But I doubt whether I should have been able to find my way out of any monastery had I been taken prisoner by the Lamas. As I practically never walked about alone in the monasteries, but joined groups of other pilgrims, I knew in most cases what to do at a given moment so as not to attract attention, and since I carefully maintained the pose of a deaf and dumb person whilst inside a monastery, the Lamas could not detect me on account of my foreign accent. These rambles through Tibetan monasteries were most interesting in spite of the fact that some of the secret rooms and sanctuaries are not accessible to pilgrims. The monasteries usually contain ornaments of considerable value and costly libraries. The most sacred books are kept under canopies, reminding one somewhat of the canopies carried about in Catholic processions. Other rooms contain gigantic reproductions of objects considered most indecent in Western countries, some of them measuring 6 feet in height. On one occasion I had a very narrow escape from being found out by the Lamas. I had waited for other pilgrims in order to join them for a visit to some of the sanctuaries. But there happened to be none who were just about to visit the place I particularly wished to visit, and since my time was limited, I intended to spend only 8 hours in the monastery, I finally decided to walk about alone, a thing I had formerly done on rare occasions only. I entered a very large room where 3 statues representing many-handed and manner-legged divinities stood in a row at one end of the room. As I thought I was quite alone, I walked about, much as does a tourist visiting a museum in a Western country. I approached the statues and carefully examined their eyes. I had a vague suspicion that the Lamas often hide somebody inside the statues of their divinities, and I hoped to find a secret entrance somewhere by which the Lamas entered them. Not having found any such entrance on the front side, I walked round the row of statues to have a good look at them from behind. I had not gone many yards before 10 or 15 secret doors were thrown open in the walls of the room and about 24 llamas rushed out and instantly surrounded me. The llamas had watched me from behind the wall. To make things worse, I had circumambulated the statues in the wrong direction. The Tibetans always walk round their idols from left to right, showing them reverently the right side of their bodies. I had done precisely the contrary. I had walked round them from right to left, which no real Tibetan would ever dream of doing. The crowd of lamas became still more suspicious when they found that I was deaf and dumb, and did not answer any of the many questions showered on me like a hailstorm. To make things still worse, one of the lamas proposed to look into my eyes in order to cure me. My blue eyes had always been a danger throughout my travels in Tibet. I could have dyed my eyes too, but, as I have stated elsewhere, I did not want to run the risk of doing harm to them by continual dyeing. And now the very fact that I was most anxious to hide, was to become the object of close scrutiny by this large crowd of suspicious priests. Only happy presence of mind saved me. I knew that according to Tibetan ideas of religion it is a dreadful crime to disturb a holy man while he prays. Then and there I sat down and went into a state of deep and motionless meditation with closed eyes. The lamas were powerless. None of them dared to approach me, but they remained standing about, waiting patiently for my prayer to come to an end. It was difficult to guess what opinion they had formed of me. They had probably never seen a white person in their lives, but nevertheless my behavior had been much too strange not to put them on their guard. So it became a matter of patience. I hoped that if I went on meditating for several hours the lamas finally would become convinced that I was really a holy pilgrim. But as the hours rolled by the situation became more desperate. After a couple of hours the crowd had increased considerably and more lamas had come to have a good look at the holy man. Finally respectful shouts were heard of Mkhonpo, Mkhonpo. It was the abbot in person who came along to see the saint. He looked very impressive in his tapering headgear, which I could clearly see through my half-closed eyes, and after glancing at me he passed on majestically. It is indescribably painful for a white man to sit in exactly the same position for many hours at a stretch, since Westerners are not used to the particular type of religious exercise. But time does not matter in the Orient. Certain religious or pseudo-religious practices in the East start by 7 years' silence, so that matter is a negligible one in Tibetan monasteries, and after several hours the crowd still stood there and gaped almost open-mouthed. To make the situation all the more critical, one of the plugs in my nostrils, which I had stuck in for the purpose of widening them and to give my nose a more genuine Tibetan aspect, began to get loose and, as the slightest movement would have been interpreted by the lamas as meaning the cessation of my pious contemplations, I could not push it back with my hand. Had the plug actually come out, a merely 50% Tibetan nose would have meant the finishing stroke. Fortunately the plug did not fall out after all. After about 5 hours of staring the time at last came when the lamas were due to take their meal. They were hungry and their appetites proved stronger than their suspicion and curiosity. I had hoped that they would all go away and leave me alone, so that I could make my escape. At the last moment, however, I was disappointed in this. After some discussion, two of the most suspicious lamas insisted on one of them remaining behind to keep an eye on me while the others went away to eat. Now my situation had become quite desperate. Flight was impossible. The nearest of the four gates of the monastery was several hundred yards distant. Had I jumped up and run away, the lama watching me would not have failed to raise the alarm and the gates would have been closed long before I could have reached them. On the other hand, I could not continue my profound devotions much longer. The pain in all my limbs was dreadful. Sooner or later I must finish. But what then? As soon as I made the slightest movement, the examination by the lamas would begin again and it would not take long before I should be in custody. Then an almost miraculous thing happened. A side door opened quietly and a solitary lama stepped out. In appearance he looked like other lamas, but one felt vaguely that he must be quite a different being. Slowly he walked up to the guard. He began to talk to him and led him away. Before they had both disappeared, the Lama who had obviously come out to help me gave me a stealthy sign with his left hand, "Go." I was saved. 5 minutes later I was beyond the walls of the monastery. The Lama who had come out from the side door must have been one of the wise men of Tibet living in the monastery as a Lama. Maybe he was wise enough to know that I meant no harm in Tibet.